that philosophy. And I'll try to explain that in a second. The other thing I want you to do, I know that when my colleague Donald Sassoon lectured here, some of you thought he was too historical, too sociological. Well, I might fall in the same trap. Unfortunately, one of the features of conservatism is it does tend to be historical. So I'll try and explain that as we go on. I'm told to speak for half an hour. I'll try to keep it to that, and hopefully you'll have some questions. I'm quite happy to go into the philosophical side of things as we go along, but I'll give you a little talk about David Hume if you want, and we'll take it from there. Anyway, I know those who do politics are studying ideologies, I think. And so just by way of just a general introduction, three points to make about this. And I will incidentally get on to David Cameron right at the end, I hope. He'll be the end point, really, of what I've got to talk about. Just three things to say about just by way of introduction. That conservatism has actually been around for 200-300 years, I guess, as a sort of body of ideas, certainly 200 years as a distinct body of ideas. But it's never been fixed, it's never been static, it's changed a lot. And I think it's because conservatism has changed a lot, it's one of the things that explains why it's been so successful politically. Had it sort of become rigid, dogmatic and so on, it probably would have died. It's been very, very flexible over time. It's been able to adapt to circumstances, and that's one of the reasons why politically it's been successful. If you look at the 20th century in Britain, the Conservative Party was in power for 66 years, I think, something like that. So two-thirds of the 20th century. Conservative Party was in power in this country. Secondly, it's varied from country to country. Unlike socialism, which tends to be an international movement, conservatism isn't an international movement, it's very, very much a national movement. It reflects the national background from which it comes. Beyond that, I think one of the things is the British conservatism, and I'm largely going to talk about British conservatism. British conservatism is markedly different from what we might call continental conservatism. Continental conservatism, especially in countries like France and Italy and Spain, has been far more doctrinal, far more rigid, far more hostile to democracy, far more hostile to the modern age than has British conservatism. So British conservatism tends to be a bit of an outlier if you compare it to other forms of conservatism. And the third thing to say by way of introduction is that it's not obviously an enclosed body of ideas. It has been influenced by other ideas, by other political ideologies, and I suppose most noticeably by liberalism. We'll talk about that later on. So that's just three things to say by way of introduction. The second thing I want to say is that conservatives themselves, and I hope you can see this, conservatives themselves tend to see other ways of thinking as being ideological. They'll say that socialism is an ideology, but they tend to say that conservatism is not an ideology. Marxists certainly say the same thing. Everything else is ideological apart from Marxism. Conservatives tend to have a similar view. Conservatism is not an ideology. It's rather a disposition. That is to say, it's a way of seeing the world. It's a frame of mind. It's a practical attitude, and so on. And I've given you a lovely quotation from someone called Michael Oakeshott, from an essay called On Being Conservative. And Michael Oakeshott was professor at the London School of Economics for many, many years, and he is arguably the most important 20th century British conservative thinker, Michael Oakeshott. And so it's a lovely essay if you want to understand the nature of conservatism in Britain, and this essay is a lovely thing to read. Incidentally, this PowerPoint presentation is actually on this computer now, so you can access, so you can get it. So it's somewhere in your system. And he says it's of conservatism, it is a disposition appropriate to a man who is acutely aware of having something to lose, which he has learned to care for. To be conservative is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, to prefer the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the limited to the unbounded. In other words, it's to prefer what you know. If you read the essay, gives lots of examples. He talks about it's being sorry when your favourite clan has died, or when you see a tree that's been chopped down which you've looked at for a long, long time. That's the conservative disposition. It's a sense of loss at something that's been familiar to you. Now, if you think about that, and that's why I began by saying lecturing to young people on conservatism is not necessarily the best thing you can do, because in a sense, conservatism, you can understand, perhaps if you look at it this way, you can understand why conservatism tends to appeal more to older people. Older people have longer memories. Older people have more things to lose. In due respect, you actually don't have much to lose. You don't own, I imagine, that you don't own hair, so some things like this. It's older people who've come to life, a particular place, lived there for a long, long time, and so on and so forth, become attached to it. And that's one of the reasons why it tends to happen that people, as they get older, go from the left to the right of the political spectrum. Older people tend to be more conservative. They have a sense of, in a sense, what they can lose. They also, incidentally, as they get older, have a greater sense of the limitations of what you can achieve. But that's the idea that Oakeshott was getting at. It's a disposition, it's a way of seeing things. And that's why, in this frame of mind, if you're a true conservative, change is something not to be welcomed, but something to be suffered. A true conservative, on the whole, would think that change will probably bring bad consequences and not good consequences. Again, if you want to understand this mentality, you can do no better than simply read the Daily Telegraph. Every day, the Daily Telegraph will tell you how bad the world is today and how much better it was before. This is a sort of standard sort of conservative. I've had my father staying with me this weekend. He's been reading the Daily Telegraph for 30 years, and he's getting on.
I was going to say, when you say before, like, what time period are you actually talking about?
Well,
you said they say that it was better before. Like,
oh,
around
yes.
What time period?
Oh, that's a very good point. Yes, when's the golden age? In other
yeah.
Words? Oh, yes. Well, that's it's never really existed, to be
oh,
frank.
Okay.
I think it's a very good point. When was the before, which was so good? It's a very good point. Now, I mean, it tends to be. Well, I think different conservatives would locate different periods. A lot, for example, would. A lot will have. I'll give you two, I think. One would locate it just prior to the First World War, the great Edwardian moment, before 1914. 1914 was the great moment when everything's destroyed. And the other one, which is going to come on to in a bit, prior to 1789, prior to the French Revolution. Yeah, but I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. It's a very good question. When was the golden age?
Do you think the 1950s might be now, like pre the 60s?
1950s also could be one. Yes, Macmillan and all of that sort of stuff. Yes, the 1960s was a bad point. Mm. If you're a conservative, yes, the 1960s is a really low moment, because that's when things really do start to go bad. But yeah, that's a very, very good question. Okay. So, well, going on from that, when was the golden age? Well, there's this other idea about conservatism. If it's a disposition, it's also something which is reactive to something. It's reacting to change. If there's no change, you've got nothing to react to. Again, this is Anthony Quinton, Lord Quinton, conservative member of the House of Lords, former academic. Conservative belief becomes explicit only in reaction to a positive, innovating attack on the traditional scheme of things. So it's very, very much a reaction to something, it's a reaction to change. Keep that title, instead of the politics of imperfection, because that's also an idea about what conservatism is. Okay, so it's a disposition, it's a reaction to change. So then we're pursuing this point. So what's the reaction against? What are the things which, in a sense, started conservatives, which helps explain the origins of conservative thinking? Well, here are three things, and possibly the second one will be the most surprising. We can first really see the origins of conservatism in this country, really about the 17th century, and in a very vague sort of form. And what were they reacting against? They were reacting against radical Protestant doctrines. And the sort of thing I have in mind, you might have heard of these, those you've done some history, think of the English Civil War. The levellers, the diggers, and all of these people who were very much inspired by Christian ideas of taking society back to, again, in their case, also back to a golden age, the Garden of Eden, where we were all equals, where property was communally owned, and all that sort of stuff. And conservatives reacted against these Protestant doctrines precisely because they were radical. They envisaged some radical social change. So that's about the 17th century. And that explains why, I think, even today, a true conservative would have a preference for established religion, that is to say, the Church of England. You know, they always used to say of the Church of England, it was the conservative party of prayer. It's not any longer, but they used to say that. So a conservative would have a preference for the Church of England as opposed to the Methodists and the Baptists and the Christadelphians and all of these sorts of things. And they'd also tend to believe in the unity of church and state. The two things should work together. And that, what that tells us, or one of the things that tells us, is conservatives, ever since then, have a sense that religion performs an important social function. Religion is one of the things which binds a community together, which binds a society together, which actually teaches people not to put themselves first, and so on and so forth. Now, the second one is the one that often surprises people, because I suppose today, if we think of conservatives, we think of the Conservative Party. What do we think about? We think of people usually pro-business, don't we? That's the sort of thing. Conservatives are pro-business. Labour's against business. Conservatives are pro-business. Well, if you go back to the origins of conservatism, conservatives were deeply suspicious about industrialisation. Remember, Britain was the first industrial economy in the world. Their preference, the conservative preference, was for, not for the industrial class, not for the entrepreneurs, the big business sons and so on. It was for the aristocracy. It was for landed wealth. Now, I don't imagine many of you have watched this programme, but it's been a great success, as some of you might have done. On Sunday evenings recently, I've been showing this programme, Downton Abbey. You've been watching that. Well, there we are. That's what I mean. The world in which is described there, notice, just before the First World War, 1914, the great crack is now going to come in. But that world in which it's described is a very conservative world. It's a world about, it's where people live. There's no industry in that thing virtually at all, isn't there, in that programme? It's a world where it's all about land. You notice it's very hierarchical, where everyone knows their place and so on and so forth. Everyone's, of course, wonderfully happy. And there's the aristocrats and the servants and all these sorts of things. This is very much a conservative vision of what a good society could be like. And the conservatives held onto that for a long, long time. In actual fact, up to about the First World War. What didn't they like about industrialisation? Well, there are various things they didn't like about industrialisation. One of them was it created the industrial working class. And there were a lot of them. And they, on the whole, were pretty ignorant and pretty impulsive. And they didn't own anything. And they had no stake in society, and so on and so forth. But they also objected to something about industrialisation itself. And in fact, this is even more true now than it was at this time. Land, the great thing about land, if you're conservative, land is stable. Land doesn't move. And communities based on land don't move. It's a stabilising thing. Money, on the other hand, moves. And because it moves, it's a force of instability. Now, this is what they wrote about in the 19th century, of course, the immortals in the 21st century. We know, don't we, that every day billions and billions of pounds move and so on and so forth. We can all be affected by this without doing anything ourselves and so on and so forth. So there was a real worry about the instability that industrialisation, that money, as opposed to land, would bring into society. And the next thing they didn't like about industrialisation. Again, compare it with Downton Abbey, where you remember there's a scene. You know the lady said you'd seen it. At the end, you've got the servant. Remember Lady Mary? She's all upset, and the servant embraces her and so on and so forth. Lovely, lovely scene. Well, you see, that's a sort of natural relationship and all this sort of stuff. The conservative like of industrialisation was it reduced the relationships between individuals to what Thomas Carlyle famously called the cash nexus. Only relationship between us is one of cash. I pay you to do a job, you do it, I pay you. That's the end of it. Affection, care, concern, and so on simply don't come into it. I'm the industrialist, I employ you. On Friday night, you get your wages, you clear off. And I don't give a damn about what you do over the weekend. I don't care about your family, and so on and so forth. contrasting this Downton Abbey sort of view of the world, where it's one big happy family. Now, remarkably, the Conservatives held on to that view right through the 19th century. Had they remained holding that view, the Conservatives politically would have been finished. They didn't, because at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, the Conservatives shifted horses. They jumped from the aristocracy to the industrial class, who they then self-consciously described as the new aristocracy. So they realised that if they were just to be the party of land, the aristocracy, there was no future. So they shifted. The third thing, more obviously, the third thing which they were, we have those first two. The third thing which conservatism reacted against was political radicalism. Political radicalism, again, which was building up. You see it again from the English Civil War onwards. But it gets its clearest expression. The thing which really terrifies, and this is, conservatism only really comes into existence clearly and coherently in 1789, in actual fact in 1790, because it's reaction to the French Revolution. And the French Revolution is, in a sense, the first attempt, in the sense that was, to fundamentally restructure society from top to bottom. This was the conservative nightmare. This is everything they feared, everything they detested. It was against religion, it was against the aristocracy, and so on and so forth. Now, the person who theorised this, the person who theorised this most of all, and this is the person who's often seen as the founder of conservatism, is a man called Edmund Burke. I'm sure you've heard of Edmund Burke. Now, if I was going to do the philosophical side of things, I'd go back a little bit earlier and I would talk about David Hume. We can talk about David Hume if you want later on. But Edmund Burke wrote this famous book, and if there's one classic book of conservatism, this book is it. Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France, published in 1790. Now, the French Revolution gets going in 1789. You might not know much about the French Revolution, but you might know this at least, that there came a point when the revolutions in France executed the king, and they executed the queen. And everybody who read, not everybody, but a lot of people who read this book, Reflection on the Revolution in France, think, he knew this, that he knew all about this. He didn't. He wrote this book before the executions, but he could see which way it's running. And he writes this very, very famous book called Reflections on the Revolution in France. And there you see him, I've just given you a sort of few. Society will be the very last will be the very last resource of the thinking and the good. Only if you're absolutely desperate, in other words, should you resort to something like revolution. On the whole, you should stick to what you have. This is what you know. If it works tolerably well, keep it. Don't throw it out, because the future is probably going to be worse than what you've got today. Also, defense of traditional beliefs. Against the doctrine of natural rights, we all now think we have rights. We've got rights to this and rights to this and so on and so forth. He saw the doctrine of rights, the notion that individuals had rights, as deeply dangerous, because he thought, and conservatives on the whole tend to think, that the language of rights is just a very sophisticated way of putting your own interests before everybody else's. And in the French Revolution, you have the Declaration of Rights among the citizens and so on. So, the defense of traditional beliefs. What should we trust to? Not to ideas and dogmas and so on. No, we should trust to what he called the spirit of a gentleman and the spirit of religion. That's where we should be guided. Go to church and be advised by the local aristocrats and so on and so forth. But he also has this lovely idea, which I think is a really super conservative idea. This is his phrase, that society, the world in which you live, is a partnership between those who are living, who are dead, and those to be born. And what he's really, all he was trying to get at there is, you know, we, in a sense, should recognise that, you know, our time, sort of here on earth, is going to be quite limited. And we have to think about all the people who came before us, and we have to think about all the people who are going to come after us. And if you think, and this is a lot of environmentalists sort of think this way. You've no right, in other words, to exploit the earth for your own good, not regard everybody else, the people who have they were before you, the people are going to come after you, and so on. So it's a way of sort of trying to get people to limit their ambition and place themselves in a much broader scheme of things than that of simply saying, well, I'm an individual and what I want is what I can get here and now. That's really the sort of idea that he was trying to get across. Now, it's a very big book, it's a very long book, and I could tell you a lot more about it. But this is the book. And if you read, not that I'm going to suggest you necessarily do it, but if you read, for example, Mrs. Thatcher's memoirs, she talks about her admiration for Edmund Burke and what he said about the French Revolution and so on and so forth. This really is the book. If there's one book of conservatism, this is the book. Reflections on the Revolution in France. Now, okay, I'll try and speed it up a little bit. I think there are different types of conservatism. There's, I think, a very traditional conservatism, and I'll say a little bit more about this later on, but this is sort of what I regard as a traditional conservatism. And the sort of things I have in mind here are, as I say, distaste for rational and radical projects and reform against social engineering. In other words, the view that sort of on the whole, the amount of good and bad in the world is going to remain just about the same. You know, on the whole, we're not going to be able to improve the world that much. And this is why, again, this idea of the politics of imperfection. In other words, you know, human beings are not all bad, but they're not all good either. Human beings are not saints. Human beings are okay, but don't expect too much of them. If you expect too much of human beings, you'll be disappointed. So don't have in mind sort of great sort of social projects of reform, because if you do, you'll be disappointed. And therefore, they're not really worth trying. A hostility towards a politics of perfection, a politics of uniformity against state planning. Again, that's all part of the sort of the attitude of against rational projects of reform. On the whole, you know, if you give the state lots of money and if the state sets out to, you know, to build lots of housing for people and so on the whole, it'll do it badly. It's a basic sort of conservative position. Far better trust to individuals to do it themselves and so on. Society comes before the individual. This is a controversial one, because if anyone knows one thing that Mrs. Thatcher said, it is there is no such thing as society, except she didn't say that. She said something else. In fact, she said that don't think about individuals. Individuals only have a place in terms of their neighbours, their families, and so on and so forth. It's that idea that, again, this is why the 1960s is bad if you're a conservative. What's the 1960s stand for? Putting the individual first, the individual's pleasure first, hedonism, and so on. That's bad. It's putting, and that's what the 60s stand for, it's individualism. Conservative tends to, if you think of Ian Duncan Smith and his reforms, which he's going to be announcing this week. Ian Duncan's analysis runs like this. It's not economic deprivation which produces dysfunctional families, it's dysfunctional families that produce economic deprivation. That's his argument. Families are good. Families are good because it teaches you something about living together, about community and all of those sorts of things. A link between morality and law. Conservatives don't buy into the liberal notion that the law should be neutral about ways of life. It thinks there is a good way of life. Therefore, a traditional conservative, for example, would tend to think it's quite proper that the law should say homosexuality is illegal, should be illegal. Because homosexuality is not a good thing. And we should own up to that. That's a very conservative attitude, and the conservatives, when Mrs. Thatcher in power, there was the famous Clause 21, was it Clause 21?
28.
Clause 28, was it, which basically said teachers couldn't basically in any way recommend homosexuality or talk about it and things. It's very much a conservative idea. The need for coalition property and interest against the force of ignorance and number. Again, conservative belief in property. Property is a good thing. If the conservatives had their way, they would actually limit a traditional conservative, and they did this for a long time, a traditional conservative would limit the right to vote to people who own property. Only people, in fact, a real conservative would say, you give the vote only to men who own property, who have children, who are married. They're the real conservatives, they would say. Property is a sort of the bastion upon which a stable society is built. Therefore, property should be protected it should not be undermined and so on. Right, let's race through. Another version of conservatism, which you might have heard of, one nation conservatism, one nation Toryism. This is very interesting because this was again very, very much a response to industrialization, the poverty of the working classes and so on. And it was very much a sort of an aristocratic response. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister, member of what's called the Young England Group, wrote novels and so on and so forth, very impressive man. He devoted himself to, as he put it, the concern to elevate the moral and social condition of the working classes. If you actually look in the 19th century, one of the great reforming governments in the 19th century, that is reforming in the sense of bringing in measures to help the working class, was Disraeli's Conservative government. A whole raft of reforms were brought in, supposedly designed to help the condition of the working classes. And this went right way through, so like Harold Macmillan, who was the Prime Minister in the late 50s, early 1960s, wrote a famous book in the mid-1930s and called The Middle Way. Conservatives like to think they're not extremes, it's a middle way. And this recommended, for example, the nationalisation of the stock exchange, the nationalisation of the banks, the nationalisation of the coal mines, and so on and so forth. Can't imagine anyone arguing this now. The only member of the Socialist Workers' Party would argue for these things now. Harold Macmillan, who becomes a Conservative Prime Minister later on, argued for these very things. So also that concern for the condition of the working classes. That, incidentally, is one of the most intriguing political phenomena of Britain in the last 100 and so years, has been the phenomenon of the so-called working class conservative. Why was it that so many members of the British working class voted conservative? And they did in enormous numbers, my father being one of them. And it was partly because they perceived that their interests were best served by the Conservative Party and not by the Labour Party. And they were, they, they, they